Accession number 14796, reel 2.
Commander Norman, reel 2.
A totally new concept of warfare and destruction. Perhaps the thing that I remember most, curiously enough, was the feeling that, oh dear, it's all over, we've missed the show. It sounds dreadful and sort of naive to say, but those were the feelings at the moment. We haven't got involved in the warfare at all. The war is over. What do we do now? Well, so be it. Those were our feelings at the time. They've matured rather since then.
What was it like flying the Avenger?
It's difficult to draw a parallel. I think what came over to us most was the sheer size of the aeroplane. When we had done our flying training on little two-seat biplanes initially, and then two-seat fixed-wing monoplanes, both low-powered, quite small, the Vulti Valiant and the North American Harvard. To step into the Avenger, in fact, was an awesome sensation, because you had to climb up a long way into the cockpit, which was your head was about 10, 15 feet perhaps above the ground. It was a big aeroplane with a rear turret for the rear gunner, a room inside the aeroplane for you could actually get 11 people in it. It had been done, I'd gather. Somebody had put a whole football team in there, fly from one station to another. But the normal crew was a navigator who sat in the middle of the behind the pilot, a rear gunner in a turret behind him, and a lower gunner down in the bowels at the back behind the bomb bay. The fact that it had a bomb bay with bomb bay doors showed you what the size of the aeroplane was. So it was a feeling of size. Once you got it going, it was a perfectly ordinary aeroplane, had very good stability, extremely heavy controls, clearly designed to prevent overstressing the aeroplane. But many, many years later, a friend of mine got briefed on and flew the Avenger back in England, and aborted the takeoff because he felt that the controls were so heavy, even at the takeoff, that he thought the control locks were still in. And just to give you some idea of it. It was quite a forgiving aeroplane. It wasn't didn't have any real vices, and it was as strong as the Fourth Bridge. But I got very fond of it in the end. Yes.
Now, was it whilst you were at Sembawang that you became involved with work to do with the Malayan Emergency?
Yes, but it was very much a secondary or tertiary role. Our role was photographic reconnaissance generally, but specifically to do a photographic survey of large parts of Malaya, Sumatra, and some of a couple of jobs to be done down in Java, in fact Indonesia, the island of Java. The involvement with the troubles in Malaysia, I seem to remember, it just required us to go from time to time to a specific location and see if we could see anything, and if we could photograph it and try and identify the precise location of what was being looked for, which were communist camps in the jungle. And naturally this was very difficult to spot, and I don't believe that we ever did actually find anything. Most of the time, 99% of what we were doing was survey work for the improvement of maps over Java, et Sumatra and a bit of Malaysia, Sumatra and a bit of Java.
Actually, I think it would be wrong to say the Malayan emergency, because that didn't officially break out until 48, and I think you were in Sembawang in 46.
Oh, it didn't officially break out, but it was all there. And I was surprised about to learn what was going on. And I do remember, in fact, being surprised to be told what it was that we were looking for. There are communists there. And suddenly realizing that this was a new threat that had already been taken recognition of, or already recognized.
What were flying conditions like climatically in Malaya?
Very good, actually. It rained very heavily each day at about 2:15. It was almost regular to that extent. It was certainly predictable and observable that it was going to rain heavily at an early afternoon. And so we could plan our flying around this. And the flying pattern was generally like this, that you would take off in the morning, around about 9, 10 or something like that, and go and do a lot of survey, which from, say, 25,000 feet, just going up and down, up and down, so that your film overlapped by about 30% on each run, parallel runs. And then when you had finished that, you would land at the nearest base, say Butterworth in Penang or Kuala Lumpur or Medan in northern Sumatra, depends on which was the nearest, because after takeoff and climb out and going to the planned position, for which you had some maps, but albeit they were very old, to show what was required to be photographed, you had to be a bit selective and not go over places where there was a lot of cloud cover. And so you had to get out there fairly early, but not so early, fairly early to avoid the cloud building up over the area you wanted to photograph, but not so early that there wasn't sufficient light. You had to let the sun come up, but get in there and photograph it before the cloud built up. So this needed a careful sort of thinking out and pre-planning. It's used to take great bundles and bundles of maps at you, and if you find one area was covered with cloud, ignore that, go on to another one, and so on, and gradually find an area which you could photograph, go down, land at this other airfield, refuel. These missions were generally about 3 or 4 hours. Change the film on the camera, put a new film magazine on the camera, and go off and try and find another one, perhaps in the afternoon, when in fact the cloud is starting to disperse, and then get back into Sembawang in the early evening. By which time, of course, the rain had been through the airfield. It was just a sort of local thundercloud, and the water had run off. And if, in fact, there was too much water on the actual grass, because it was essentially a grass airfield, you could land on this 400-foot-long concrete strip, for which the Hellcat's deck landing capabilities were very helpful. Albeit the strip didn't have an arrestor gear, but the Hellcat was an aeroplane designed to land on aircraft carriers, had good handling characteristics at low speed, and you could plop it down there at the minimum speed right on the end of this strip, and you would just roll very slowly off the other end, but not to endanger the aeroplane at all. And if there was any problem of taxiing because the grass was so wet, you just left the aeroplane there, and you got some Japanese to pull it out.
Did you ever get any ground fire?
No. The war was over, and there was the communists weren't in that sort of mode of attacking aircraft. But the war was over. There were, in fact, still Japanese flying, of course, and I well remember going down to Batavia, Kemeradon airfield, at what is now Jakarta, to do a survey of the road going from Jakarta to Bandung, and I landed and was allowed to backtrack up the runway by air traffic control to an intersection of runways. And as I got to this intersection, I wanted to cross it, but I saw a Japanese aeroplane, little two-engined aeroplane, on the airfield there, still with its markings rubbed out, but it was taxiing up the other runway. And it stopped, and we both stopped there at the intersection. The hatch at the top opened. A Japanese officer stood up there with his cap on, saluted, bowed, and offered me the way to cross, which I did, right in front of him. And I always thought that was a rather curious experience so soon after the war. But it transpired that the Japanese had been contracted, if that's the right word, to help the Dutch government in Java at the time in the clearing out of or looking in the jungle from the air towards the end of clearing out various insurgents and anti-Dutch factions that were operating. Indeed, they may well have been communists as well. And so, in fact, they had... It was a little air force of its own, being run by the Dutch and manned by the Japanese, flying the remains of their air force. And they were only little training aeroplanes. They had no hitting capability. An odd experience.
So Japanese flyers were being used against the Indonesians?
Yeah, sure. Yes. Now, not quite sure what the faction was called. I'm trying to remember. But they in fact, I think, were communist-inspired and were creating quite a lot of trouble at the time. Ambonesians, I think they were.
How did you respond to this display of etiquette from the Japanese pilot?
I acknowledged... I acknowledged the fact that he'd given me right away, and just with a cheery wave, as far as I can remember, and taxied across. Didn't do anything else. I didn't really know who the hell he was. That he seemed to be wearing a Japanese uniform, and I subsequently found out exactly what he was.
Now, I think you went on a school of naval air warfare course after this.
Yes, just before we get on to that, going back to that particular mission, and indeed it was typical of many that we did during that photographic reconnaissance exercise, the squadron that I belonged to, 888 Squadron, was, together with one other squadron, an RAF-1 Flying Mosquitoes from Singapore at the time, the only outfit doing photographic reconnaissance, I believe, in that area at that time. And the idea was to try and update the maps and charts of the maps particularly, of course, of the whole area, which had been found to be grossly in error. And when I went down to Jakarta on that particular sortie mission, it was to take photographs on this road out to Bandung, and all of those maps, all of those photographs were subsequently used as the basis for making maps in that area, and may well still be in being issued.
Now, what type of things did you learn when you went to the School of Naval Air Warfare later in that year?
There were essentially two courses running in parallel at the school, as I remember it at the time. One, both directed towards producing qualified air warfare instructors, and one part ran it for air warfare instructors, fighter or whatever it was, fighter or ground attack, and the other one was for air warfare instructors, brackets R, for reconnaissance. And indeed it was to become an air warfare instructor reconnaissance that I was sent to the school and qualified as such shortly afterwards.
We should say this was at St. Marin, Royal Naval Air Station.
Correct, that's at St. Marin, yes. And I was flying Fireflies and Firefly 4s and Seafire 3s for that purpose.
What were those two aircraft like to fly?
The Seafire was exactly what one imagines it to be. Lightweight, reasonably high performance, totally different from all the American aeroplanes that I'd been flying for a variety of reasons. One was that they had, starting off, if you got the aeroplane started, the propeller went round the opposite way to the American aeroplanes. And this was very important to remember when you were doing a takeoff, because you put on full power on any single engine propeller driven aeroplane, it wants to go round, turn round in one direction or the other, depending on which way the propeller goes round. And you accordingly keep the aeroplane straight by applying rudder in the appropriate direction and adding on a bit of trim to help as well. And if you get it wrong, of course, it merely exacerbates the ground loop that subsequently happens. So that was the first thing to learn. Secondly, that it was a very much lighter aeroplane. In fact, the Seafire was unbelievably light compared with the Avenger, particularly, and the Hellcat to a degree. The Hellcat was... The Hellcat, being built by Grumman's as well, was pretty heavy for a fighter anyway. And so one had to be careful not to overdo it with the Seafire. The other thing, too, was that the Avenger's cockpit was enormous. In fact, it had arms armrests on the pilot's seat. The Hellcat was only slightly smaller, and the Seafire was a tight fit, or at least, of course, that was the impression you got, because to get the maximum level performance out of the aeroplane, Mitchell had designed the aeroplane to be as slender and have the minimum frontal area. The Firefly was in much the same mould, but was a slower aeroplane. It was a different role altogether. It was a patrol, reconnaissance, anti-submarine aeroplane, not a fighter, although it had, I think it had 420mm cannon, which could have been quite useful in a dogfight, but it was essentially a patrol aeroplane. I think those are the things that I remember mostly. One of the things I do recall of that time had nothing to do with the actual course itself, but right at the end of the course, it so happened that the air station had an air day, and the air station was open to a lot of visitors, and there were a lot of flying activity, and people put on a bit of a display of this and a bit of a display of that. And there was, in fact, for the School of Naval Air Warfare, a dummy deck landing competition to see who could get the best result out of three landings. And you were required to, the target was in fact to have the main wheels one side of a line drawn across the runway and the tail wheel touching down at the same time, a perfect three-point landing, the tail wheel on the other side of the landing and going in the right direction, of course. And everybody put in some money, and I'm happy to say that I won first prize, £5, a lot of money in those days, and we drank it all in the pub that night.
And the other planes you were flying then?
Those were the only two on the course, the only two aeroplanes that were used on the course.
I think there was one plane that you were telling me about earlier, which you described as the worst aircraft in the world that you flew a bit later.
That was some time later, and it was perhaps not fully justified. There are many aeroplanes, I think, that pilots would consider to be the worst. I think the aeroplane I'm talking about, there was the Firebrand, Blackburn Firebrand. When many years later, I was in a Firebrand squadron. It was designed as a torpedo bomber to take the place of the Barracuda, which many people would say was the world's worst aeroplane. The Barracuda was underpowered, but not strictly so. It was more overdragged and it's a well-known story about how the operational requirement for that aeroplane got slightly out of hand, and nobody paid too much attention to the drag of the aeroplane in its design, as long as the objective of having the aeroplane was achieved. And so it grew all sorts of drag-worthy bits and pieces on the outside. And it had a lot of drag. And this had a profound effect on that aeroplane, particularly operating in the tropics. The Firebrand, on the other hand, had plenty of power and was quite clean. It was hideous to look at. It didn't have anything of aesthetic beauty about it. It had an enormous fin area and a large tailplane, which helped it keep straight during takeoff, but of course it was an absolute SOD when you were taxiing in a crosswind, because the thing continually wanted to point up into wind. And this meant that it was the only way you could steer the airplane was by using the brakes, the pneumatic brakes, and they weren't terribly good. And so there were a number of occasions when that airplane either ran off the Perry track or you just had to leave it and get it towed back home. Reverting back slightly, just to, there was one other difference that occurred to me in flying British aeroplanes for the first time at the School of Naval Air Warfare at St. Marin, was that the braking system on the aeroplanes were entirely different between the British braking system, pneumatically driven brakes on the main wheels that were operated by a combination of rudder application. You put your right foot forward, i.e. you put on full right rudder, and then you squeezed a handle on the joystick which allowed air to go through to the right hand brake if you wanted, and so you could turn to the right, similarly to the left if you had your left foot out. If you wanted to just slow the aeroplane up and keep straight, you put the rudder central and squeeze the handle. The American system, they were all hydraulically operated brakes, and they were operated by a pedal, integral part of the rudder bar. And so if you wanted to turn to the right, you just depressed the pedal on the right-hand rudder, and similarly to the left if you wanted to turn to the left, and both together if you wanted to stop. The initial shock of using the British braking system was soon overcome. It wasn't all that difficult. It was just the first time you used it, you had to remember what to do. And it was no good wiggling your ankles in a British aeroplane and expecting the aeroplane to stop. You had to use your hands as well. The Firebrand, in fact, had these rather weak brakes and this enormous fin area which tended to turn the aeroplane into wind, and so taxiing wasn't easy. But the real drawback of the design of the Firebrand was that they had put the fuel tank in between the engine and the cockpit. It was a large fuel tank, very long, and consequently the cockpit was a long way back. The engine was a Centaurus engine, large radial engine, and they had not put the cockpit high enough up so that you could get a view over the front of it. It was extremely difficult. In fact, it was impossible to see anything closer than about 30 degrees either side of the bow, of the nose of the aeroplane when you were taxiing. And when you were deck landing, in fact, it was only just possible to see the port aft corner of the flight deck where the batsman was standing, and maybe one of his bats when you were doing a deck landing. That made life difficult, and it had one or two other characteristics too which were a bit strange, but then most aeroplanes have. I mean, for example, there were, I think, something like 14 levers down on the left-hand side, all neatly grouped up and controlling various flaps or radiator gills or undercarriage, the tailwheel locking and pitch and mixture and throttle and so on, many others down there. And so it became sort of rather like flying a Hammond organ at times, with your left hand making all these levers down there. I have to say that after the first couple of hundred hours or so, you got used to the aeroplane. And I finished up, in fact, with quite a lot of deck landings and quite a lot of numbers of hours on the airplane. But I never really liked it. It had spring balance controls too, which were very odd to handle at anything other than actually flying in the air. As soon as you got down on the ground, everything felt very strange indeed. I won't go into the technicalities of why there was these spring balance controls, other than to say that they made the feel of the aeroplane when it was flying very good. On the ground, it was something else.
Now, can we go on to the Korean War and your operational flying in that, please?
Yes, it started in a curious way. The Korean War in 1950, in the autumn of 1950. At that time, I was flying firebrands in Implacable in Norway. Or the ship was in Norway when the Admiralty decided that the Admiralty, in fact, I think was probably slightly embarrassed by the fact that the war had broken out just as the carrier on the Far East Station, HMS Triumph, was about to leave. In fact, she was on her way to Hong Kong. On her, the first leg of her return home at the end of her commission out there. And she was in need of a refit. Many of the aircranes, particularly those in the fighter squadron, the 800 squadron, the flying CFAR 47s, were in dire need of overhaul. In fact, I believe as many as four airplanes out of the 12 in the squadron were grounded because of stretching of the fuselage on deck landings. And nobody bothered too much about that because the ship was on the homeward leg and we won't fly those until we ship them ashore in UK. So everybody was slightly embarrassed when war broke out and she was ordered back into Korean waters and the airplanes were hastily made as serviceable as they could. But there was the Admiralty, in fact, decided that they would supplement the air crew in the CFAR, in the Firefly squadron, at least, in order to cope with a much expected much higher flying rate. And so, myself and three other pilots from different units in the UK were designated to get out there as quickly as we possibly could. I went ashore that night. The signal arrived in the ship, somewhat puzzled that I, as a firebrand pilot, was being sent out to join a Firefly squadron in Korea. I caught a train down to Oslo, caught a Dakota over to London, went and saw the appointer, pointed this out to him, and he looked a bit puzzled, shuffled through some papers and said, "Oh yes, I see, yes, I hadn't thought of that. Never mind, we'll send you on a course to learn to fly the Firefly up at Naval Air Station at Eglinton, Northern Ireland." So I did a quick conversion there onto the Firefly, lasting about 10 days. Beetled back by ferry and train to the south again and along to Lynham to catch an aeroplane, an RAF Transport Command aeroplane, out to Singapore and joined up with the other three members of the replacement air crew. And we climbed aboard this York and set off towards Malta, our first stop. And at the top of the climb, the door opened from the cockpit.